I don't have a car.
So that's not really a car, that's right.
Oh, no.
It says to record the response and to call. How do you end the call?
I'm Mary Ellen Charles, the chair, and the very, very lucky civil authority. We are here in the flesh in person for the first time in 2 years. Yay! I'm sure that's due in large part to a lot of the incredible work of all of our jurisdictions during the pandemic over the last year. So here we are, vaccinated and masked. Ready. I will call to order and Zoom will call.
Thank you, Chair. City and County of San Francisco.
Mary Ellen Charles here.
County of Alameda.
Richard Gia here.
City and County of San Francisco.
Eric Artisaros here.
City of Oakland.
Jessica
Connell
here.
City of San Jose.
Greg Bearden here.
County of Santa Clara.
Here.
County of Contra Costa.
Brian Borger with Contra Costa County here.
County of Marin.
Greg Sturdy and Rick Pacheco's office here.
County of Monterey.
Gary Malone here.
County of San Mateo.
Mark Robbins here.
And County of Sonoma.
Good morning, Jeff Walker.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Okay, so the next item two, is approval of the minutes. Hopefully everyone has had a chance to review. Are there any comments, additions, corrections to the minutes on the part of the approval board? Okay, seeing none, we can open it up to public comment. Is there any public comment on the minute?
Hi, is the mic working? Hello? Hi. Blair Beekman here. Thanks for the meeting today. It's nice to be back. It's nice to be in this place again. It's been about 18 months, I think. I wanted to summarize my feelings of the previous agenda minutes. A very much of a thank you that you have. Are you using the idea of when approval authority persons ask questions in the final items of the minutes last time, you show the idea of that where a person can review the previous September meeting where the approval authority persons have talked about an issue and you include the minutes. That's a new feature, and I thank you very much for doing that. I know Gary Millay has been trying to ask about that issue for a long time, and it could be a real good answer to a person can now review what authority persons are speaking about during when if they review the minutes. And that's a very nice feature to be working on. The public comment is, maybe in the future of a few more additional adjectives to describe public comment from people can be of help. Some of it's pretty good, and I thank you for that. And quality of life. It's 18 months ago, I was asking about meeting minutes ideas as quality of life issues. And it's nice that you're doing this, and it's nice that we're finding ways to grow in this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, can we go on to approve the minutes? We have a motion.
So moved.
Second?
Second. Mrs. Chair?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. And we will move on to the general manager's report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few items. There are two action items that will need action after the report. The first item, which is a discussion, is our grants. We received notice of our UWASE grant for $30.5 million. FEMA had placed financial hold on four of our projects, one cybersecurity project and three involving domestic violent terrorism. We're in communication with FEMA and Cal OES essentially to provide them with more information so that we would obtain a release on those holds. We are in the process of sending out the MOUs for the fiscal year 2021 jurisdictions. So that they can start incurring expenses to the fiscal year 2021 award. The other area is our, we were lucky this year, we received approximately $1 million regarding the our Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention Grant, TVTP. We're the only UWASE in the United States that had received that award. We're the second highest in the jurisdiction. The highest was the University of Colorado. So that's 2 years in a row that we received an award in PBTBP. And that grant goes toward awareness different types of training throughout the Bay Area. Moving on to our 2022-2023 project proposal process. Thanks to Mary and her team, we received approximately 200 applications, approximately an amount of $63 million, which is $2.2 million from the anticipated funding. We looked at all the applications for grant compliance during the process of being sent to the respective board members. For review to ensure that they line up to your strategy of your jurisdiction. And that time is from November 8th through the 26th. And then Mary is going to then coordinate the hub voting meetings in January. The North Bay Hub is first on January the 12th, followed by South Bay Hub on the 21st, then East Bay Hub on the 14th. And lastly, the West Bay Hub on January the 26th. The next is an action item that I'm going to ask for an action on. It is the approval of the 2022 calendar. Essentially, everything's going to remain the same as this year. There are five meetings. The meetings are they're attached to the as Appendix A. January the 13th, March the 10th. June the 9th, September the 8th, and November the 10th. And these are the second Thursdays of those months at the same place here at 10 o'clock. Nothing has changed as far as time and place. And the other action item is an acceptance and approval of a revision to our 2021 master MOU. As you may recall, back in September, we presented this. We approved the master MOU, and then later, some of the county council in the region had some questions on one provision, and I think it's provision 8. So we went back and had conversations with the entire region's county council and deleted that provision, and attached to the GM report is a line item that shows that has been deleted. And as our team has been contacting the various jurisdictions, county council, and that language was accepted throughout the region. The next item is a discussion-only item, just an update regarding our management team. Previous go out to Corinne Marshall. She floated up to the program manager of the Bay Area Training Exercise Program, the Bay Tech Program. We did a great summit conference exercise that occurred, you know, this year. And more about that in agenda item 6, where she's going to give an update regarding our program. Matthew Devine, he's here. Welcome to the WASI management team as the training and exercise project manager. He will be overseeing the training course administration for the region-wide program. Before joining the UASI, he served 28 years in Santa Rosa Fire Department as a captain medic. He is a state certified fire officer involved in numerous projects, including training, policy development, and technical committee member on the NFPA 1600 standard on continuity and emergency and crisis management. He has worked with schools throughout the Bay Area for the past 15 years as an emergency consultant, focusing on risk analysis, training, delivery, and digital planning. He is the founder of a mobile application for emergency communications widely used by K through 12 schools in the Bay Area. He is a San Francisco native and holds a BA from UC Davis and multiple certifications in emergency management. So, Matt, welcome. Welcome to the team. And then the last item is our future tracking team, our tracking tool. Our next meeting is going to be in January. And in January, we definitely, on an annual basis, we have our election of WASI officers. We will discuss the 2022 national priority projects. We will then have an update regarding our risk management program kickoff, as well as an update regarding our program annual reports, and then our spending reports, all set for January. So this completes the GM report, and as I mentioned, I would ask for the two action items, the approval of our 2022 calendar first, and then followed by the revision of our master MOU. So with the calendar, we have a motion to approve.
Can I have a question first? Chair, question?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, actually, Craig, thank you. Two questions and one acknowledgement. Acknowledgement first, thank you for reworking the MOU. I thought that was kind of subverted the concerns of some legal counsel, so thank you on that. On the approval of the calendar, I noticed that it says the meetings are 10 on Zoom or at this location. Are we going to have a hybrid situation where from now during the year we're able to do both or just in person? And then the second question is, under the training and exercise, are we still in partnership with SenseMakers on that? It's another I mentioned.
First of all, my intention is to have them here for 2022, but, you know, there's a lot of, you know, conditions on that depending upon where we are with the pandemic, and if we need to go back to the Zoom meeting, then we shall. But for the calendar, it would be an in-person meeting in January throughout the year. The second question regarding the SenseMaker, I'll refer that over to Corinne.
So our current contract with SenseMakers, the support for administrating the program goes through the end of this calendar year. Over the past 6 months, we've been transitioning and training our new team. Christoph and Matt is here. We have a full-time Karen fiscal analyst. So SenseMakers has been training our team to take more of the work in-house on the UASI management team. We have awarded a contract to SenseMakers for 2022 for minimal support. They'll be providing two training coordinators, the law enforcement training coordinator and the cyber and public information training coordinator. And after 2022, we plan to have all of the Bay Tech program operations internally on the OASA management team.
Thank you.
Question, what is the calendar? Is anyone seeing it?
I believe it's in the
appendix. It's the appendix A.
Rich and I are having a meeting. You can't find it. Here.
Hi, Blair Beekman here. It's a little strange being talking into a microphone instead of the phone. So, hi again. Try to practice public speaking in public. I'm interested in the ideas of the financial, the targeted violence and extremism, terrorism and prevention ideas. That will be spoken about a bit later. And about the financial year reports, project proposal reports for 2022 and 23. I was mentioned, I think, in January those reports will be coming. And I've written a few letters to yourselves with the idea of the importance of. It sounds like a really good new system we have developing for project proposal ideas and. How to budget it, and I'm interested in it. I'm interested in what can be the accountability for the process, and I suppose I can talk about that more at the budget items at the end of the meeting. And I just wanted to mention it at this time. Its importance, its good value of a better future we're moving towards, peace and not war. I think that's what it can be its goals, and to work towards this. Openness, accountability, and transparency, with good practices, and good agenda item meetings that can appear on. That's a good future course to set ourselves on. So, thank you.
Everyone's favorite talk, but it's certainly mine. Thank you for. Do I have a little clicker? Awesome. Excellent. All right. Thank you, Amy Ramirez, a Regional Risk Management Project Manager. I think I know everybody here. Thank you. So this item does require your approval at the end of the agenda. So as you know, every year, as Homeland Security grant recipients, everyone is required to complete a THIRA and SPR. And the UWASI management team, with support from all the subject matter experts in the region, basically work together every year to complete this process on the region's behalf. The THIRA is a Threat and Hazard Identification and Risk Assessment, and the SPR stands for Stakeholder Preparedness Review, which is the Capability Assessment portion of the process. So the THIRA is actually on a three-year cycle, according to FEMA, and so we're not required technically to have made any updates this year, but we did edit a few of the scenarios and make some changes. You'll see in the version you have, those are just the edits we made for this year, and next year we'll be doing a complete overhaul of the THIRA. So we added a pandemic influenza scenario. We also added an improvised nuclear device scenario. We received some scenarios from Lawrence Livermore Lab about a year and a half ago, and we just added that scenario as well as updated the radiological dispersal device impacts, which was some more data we received from them, so those are more accurate. And then in addition to the THIRA being where we identify our threats and hazards and create the context, which are the scenarios, step three of the THIRA is to establish the capability targets. So that's where we say, this is what our goal is. And there were several core capabilities that FEMA, we had not yet been required to do. So community resilience, threat and hazard identification, forensics and attribution. So we set the capability targets this year for those three. In terms of the SPR, the stakeholder preparedness review, this one is required every year. FEMA, I think, took some pity on us and didn't require every single core capability be updated. I think they realized that there was still a lot of staffing issues due to COVID response. So this year, what you have in front of you for the SPR are just the ones that were required that we update, with the addition of two core capabilities that we had made a lot of investments in, operational communications and transportation were two that were not required, but we did do the assessment this year. And basically what we did is we worked with our stakeholders and subject matter experts in all the different core capabilities and mission areas, and we asked them to tell us what had changed in terms of, you know, from prior years. You know, had we gained capacity, had we lost capacity, and why do we still have gaps, and what were some gap closing strategies? So that's what's captured in the SPR for you. And then, of course, for the capability targets that we set in the THIRA, we also went through the process and did the assessment of the current level of ability to meet the target. This slide is shows you some our current level of ability for the capabilities that we assessed this year. We did lose capacity in a couple of our core capabilities, so public health, and interdiction and disruption, and that was really largely due to staffing issues, burnout from, you know, this long of a response to COVID, plus all the other incidents that were still ongoing, lots of retirement, attrition, lack of training that people were receiving. We gained capacity in all the ones in green there, so a couple of those to note are I think operational communications, we gained capacity there, and that was largely due not just to equipment being finally put in place, a lot more P25s were distributed, but also because we started thinking about operational communications more broadly than just voice communications, and really all of the ways we have to communicate using data. Another one that gained in percentages was screening, search, and detection, and that was attributed to the start of the Securing the Cities program. So the next step is we submit the THIRA and SPR to FEMA at the end of the year, once we have your approval. There were a few things that we didn't make quite as much progress on as we had hoped, largely due to COVID response. One of those things was a dashboard that FEMA has been working on that they released an early version of last year, and it's designed to help us visualize our strengths and weaknesses, as well as to show us sort of how we compare to other UWASIs in the country. And we got really excited about that, but there were some issues with it, and we provided feedback, and we're still waiting for them to release that to us again. So I'm hoping in 2022 we'll be able to provide some cool graphs and comparisons of the data over time. And then the other thing we're still working on is coordinating with Cal OES on their THIRA and SPR. So, you know, California is unique. We have a lot of UWASIs, and so it does make it a little bit harder to create a system where the UWASIs that are created the SPRs that are created at the UWASI and tribe level throughout a state then all roll into a state THIRA and SPR. And we're still working with Cal OES on trying to figure out how to get closer to that. For 2022, I'll present more thoroughly on this in the January meeting, but we are working on how do we do a better job of measuring from year to year the investments we're making, especially around the national priority areas, and it's looking like we'll probably have to create our own capability targets and assess those every year in addition to the standardized capability targets that FEMA requires. So we'll be hearing more about that. We're also looking at how do we better integrate the THIRE and the SBR into all of our UASI programs and all of the projects that we fund at the subgrantee level as well. So how are we doing that? How are we doing showing return on investment for the investments that we make? So this item does require your vote, and of course, what you have in front of you, we will provide. I can provide an electronic version of the full document to everybody. That would be available in January once it's all compiled under the FEMA in the FEMA portal where we submit it. So I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah.
Can we just stay there for a second? Can we see if there's any questions or comments from
this is Erica from San Francisco. I do have a question on the graphs on the dashboard. Mm-hmm. How publicly is that demonstrating the weaknesses? Like, where does that live?
Yes, that is really a very good question. So that's one of the things we have to figure out is, the information we have here is FOUO, it certainly could be used in the wrong hands for something that we would not want it to be used for. That's one of the things we're going to have to figure out is how to ensure that that it stays, especially as we have better ways to, easily visualize it. I mean, right now, if you want to read through the entire document, that's one thing, but certainly to just get a snapshot of it, we would have to make sure that that's very secure. Yeah.
Any other questions?
You have to move. No.
You can sound.
Oh, okay, so I have one more item as well that I have. Not an item, but after this, I have one more just thing to add on. Sorry.
Oh, well, why don't you do that now before?
Okay. Well, so typically at this time, I usually also present on the hub funding formula. And per our cycle, this is the year we're supposed to refresh the population and the economic data in the hub funding formula. Unfortunately, both the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Economic Authority have not released their data yet, which it's very delayed this year. So the population density data, the Census website says it'll be available sometime in December, and the GDP by county, which is the information we get from the Bureau of Economic Authority, says early December, like December 8th. So the hope is that I will have this in time to present to you at the January Approval Authority, but in case you were wondering why that wasn't on the agenda, that's why.
Okay, public comments?
Hi, Blair Beekman. I guess, just to continue old traditions here, I always comment on fiber issues that I feel it's important that, there it sounds like, there's an industry with THIRA that we're understanding that I think it's possible we can. I'm always hopeful of the ideas of sharing, technology sharing with different communities with THIRA issues. And I think it develops a sense of camaraderie and unity and better communication. And I know in the past few years we've all been liking being able to work as individual cities on THIRA issues, but just a reminder of what can be good practices. And I wanted to offer something of I was very interested in what the item spoke of, what you're working towards and all of the goals and percentages of things of how to work on issues, to ask what can be the public health and safety questions from this work. That's an interesting idea, and there's a few other items that were of interest, and good luck in that work. I'm a bit concerned about the idea of that you sometimes practice using live radiological equipment or, you know, to practice. I question that a bit, just to note. And to finally offer a very much of a thank you that a few years ago, in November of 2019, you had a very nice lecture from a person who spoke on radiological things escaping from local laboratories within this country. It was a very interesting precursor to the concepts of COVID-19 arriving, and I thank you for that sort of work and effort, and that you have issues of flu, interestingly, how to connect those sort of items in your future. Good luck, and interesting work that, you know, how you can talk about how we can prepare for our future, and that we can do that here. That's an interesting concept, and I thank you for those sort of efforts.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Okay, it passes. Our next item is on the trial operation. Emma Horton.
Great. Hi, good morning. My name is Emma Hunter. I'm the regional coordinator for the Association of Bay Area Health Officials, ABAHO, and giving an update today on our vaccine point of dispensing operations plan project that we've been working on for the past year. So the primary stakeholders of this project, it was originally intended as a bioterrorism exercise project for ABAHO and its subcommittee of the Bay Area Mass Prophylaxis Working Group. Due to COVID, the project scope was modified to be more specifically related to COVID because we thought we had enough time to make that happen and be relevant. As time progressed, we once again adjusted the scope of work to be a more generic vaccine response so that it was more applicable to all hazards as opposed to just the specifics of the COVID-19 vaccine operations. So as part of this project, we had the deliverables to review local plans, conduct site visits of COVID-19 vaccine operations, develop these operational plans, and to conduct trainings. And so the contractors went out, they visited vaccine operations starting in February, March, April of this past year. They conducted documented best practices and put together master plans for interoperability and compatibilities across the region for setting up, managing, and operating these vaccine points of dispensing. So as a result, we now have these operational plans and three field operating guides. So the plans really lay out the process for the setting up, the management, and the high-level operation of the vaccine pods, but they're very high-level. They don't get into the nitty-gritty, and that's why we have the field operating guides to address three different models of vaccine operations. So the first is like a walk-in model, the second is a drive-through, and then the third is mobile. And these have been scaled to include resource typing for each of the models to include minimum number of staff and types of staff and types of resources required for each of these different models. So our next steps, we are conducting two trainings upcoming on these two documents. The first is a high-level overview, they're both train the trainers, but the first is a high-level overview on how to present the needs of vaccine operations to high-level leadership, to identify to executives what type of staffing is going to be required, how many staff will probably have to be pulled from routine operations to work in these pods, and to just lay the groundwork for the future. And the second training is a train the trainer on the actual field operating guides. So this is more of a training the operational level folks who would have to take in either volunteers or reassigned staff to work at these operations, and to really just-in-time train them into operations. So those are upcoming, and we are looking forward to closing out this project. It's been several iterations, but we're happy with our final product. Thank you.
Okay, we're good. And I just have a quick question on the training part. How is that, who's being notified about the training, and how is that being, advertised as well?
So
to the various companies, to all the entities here.
So because they are train the trainers, it is a smaller audience, because a lot of the folks are still involved actually doing vaccine operations, and we felt it was redundant to train people on operations when they were currently doing those exact operations. So we set it up as a train the trainer, so that we can get the mid-level management prepared to, if they need to do this again in the future, to train up volunteers and people without the experience. So it's coming out to Abajo. So we have our public health preparedness subcommittee with representatives from the 13 Abajo jurisdictions, as well as the Bay Area Mass Prophylaxis Working Group with representatives as well. And we will be opening it up for them to send it to their specific vaccine teams and communicable disease teams, if there's any interest for folks to attend the training there. Mm-hmm.
So is your training audience health department mid-managers? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, yeah. And then they will be trained to be able to, deliver this in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other comments or questions for Emma? Okay, and then we'll move to public
comment. Hi, Claire Beekman here. I've been practicing a nice little speech that I speak to City of San Jose, Fremont, County of Santa Clara, and City of Berkeley. And I've been trying to practice a speech about the importance of mask use at this time, and that there are issues of COVID. It's growing once again in Europe, and that invariably means it will be here again sometime soon in larger numbers. And so the importance of mask use, it's an important concept for ourselves, I think. And from that, as we're introducing a new vaccine process to young people at this time, I think it's important we have to continue the ideas of explaining what exactly the vaccine process is, and what it can be about, and what are its benefits, what are its drawbacks, what are our lifestyle choices from the vaccine process. I hope that can learn to be a more and more open conversation for ourselves. And with that said, I think it's really important that the work that we do with the future of surveillance and technology and data collection, and its open public policy ideas and guidelines that I always talk about here, it's a perfect way to have those sort of conversations about our future and what are our good practices. And I think it can be a place where all sides, we're talking about terrorism issues, and people are so upset, I'm sure, about these things. I think to have, surveillance and technology, open public policy ideas, is a way to invite all sides to a process and ask, what is our future? What can be our future good decisions out of what we're doing right now? And it's a really important concept that I think we have to work on. I don't know how to say it better, but or work it better, but I can at least say it here, and thank you for your patience to allow me to say these sort of things at this time.
All right, thank you. So we're now on a regular cycle of briefing on the Bay Area Training and Exercise Program at every approval authority meeting. And so here is your update for today. We're starting to look at 2021 as a whole and putting our annual report together, which we'll present at the January meeting. So these numbers will get more finalized, but in a whole, it looks like we've done about 140 training courses this year compared to 2020, where we actually only operated the program for 6 months of the year and was almost exclusively virtual, and we did 55 courses in 2020. So we're on a good track, and we're looking at about 150 courses in 2022. So we're finding our balance for the new format of the T&E program. We are aiming to deliver priority trainings to these public safety disciplines equitably. So we've looked, historically the T&E program was law enforcement, fire services, and then sort of everything else was lumped into an emergency management and EMS kind of group. So we've identified where the needs are and broken that out a little bit more, added community preparedness as a service, as a discipline last year, and that's going very well. Of note, obviously the public health folks were busy in 2021 and in 2020, so they are now able to engage, and we have a good list of courses to offer to the public health discipline for next year, so you'll see that number go up in 2022. And then here's a visual on the spread of number of students trained within each of the public safety disciplines. So we watch these to make sure we're covering all of these disciplines. And even though we only did one course for public health, it was a psychological first aid course, which was in high demand, and we did it virtually, and the recorded modules are available to view. So we were able to get high volume from that one course, and it's still available for anybody to watch and view after the fact. We always like to put up a few complimentary quotes to lift our spirits, remind ourselves that our training and exercise program is really helping. This year, many of the law and fire courses filled up like that, especially the hands-on courses, so we're taking all that into account what the high demand courses are, and beginning our procurements for 2022 scheduling. And so, the piece de resistance, our big event of the year, coming out of our COVID cocoons, we held the first annual Bay Area UASI Public Safety Preparedness Summit. We looked at it as a capstone opportunity to put our big exercises, mass notification seminar, a lot of our major UASI investments, a capstone opportunity for featuring those and coming together as a region. So the summit started off with the Golden Eagle exercise, which unfortunately didn't happen in 2020, so it was our time to come back and practice as a region. As you all know, you were, activated and busy with COVID, so it wasn't really a rare opportunity to activate the Emergency Operations Center like this exercise was in the past. But we did have great participation throughout the region, and actually probably the biggest participation we've had from Cal OES at the state level than we've ever had in this exercise in the past. We had more than 45 people at the State Operations Center, and a few Cal OES representatives out in the operational areas. It was the first time that the ESF-1 transportation task force stood up at the state level. So Caltrans and Cal OES were working on the resource requests and how they coordinate at the state level. They were very grateful and playing big, and the exercises really helped them develop how the ESF1 task force will come together. So we look forward to more big participation from Cal OES as we go forward with the Golden Eagle exercises in the future. I think it was a big hurdle in getting on their radar and getting on the state level exercise calendar. The Bay Area Joint Information System activated, which was a great opportunity for some of the newer public information officers who kind of joined in with the Joint Information System during COVID, could practice their local roles of public information as well as the benefits of being part of the regional Joint Information System and the collaboration that happens through there. We had three full-scale commodity points of distribution in Hayward, Los Gatos, and Solano County. That piece of the exercise was funded through the RCPGP grant as part of the CPOD planning project, so that was a nice integration. In all, we had approximately 30 Bay Area public agencies, including the NCRIC, and 10 local transit agencies, plus Caltrans at the state level, engaged in the exercise. A lot of jurisdictions started off planning for the exercise, and then COVID and different things, so some agencies had to pull out at the last minute, but all of the work is not lost. We are planning to parlay all of this forward into a full-scale critical transportation operations exercise in May of 2022. So we're not losing the momentum. At the after-action meeting, we're going to go right into concepts and objectives. What did we learn in Golden Eagle? Where are we at? And which pieces do we want to do a full-scale drill on in May? After the Golden Eagle exercise, we had 2 days of seminar and training events at the Hyatt Regency in San Francisco. It was a great venue, and we're grateful to Mary Ellen for kicking off the event with a keynote address. I don't know if you heard Mary Ellen, but throughout the rest of the day, people who were asking questions to the panels kept referring back to Mary Ellen's points. Well, as you heard Mary Ellen say this morning, and so it was very impactful. It helped set the tone for the whole day and made the conversations throughout the rest of the day meaningful. We had over 200 people on site at the Hyatt over the 2 days, and approximately 30 people were watching the live stream. I wasn't sure how well a live stream of our conference was going to go, but the AV all apparently worked well, and folks who were unable to come on site for whatever reason could watch it live stream, so that functioned. And we do have all the mass notification seminar sessions recorded and available to view on our website. The training courses for community preparedness, for terrorism awareness, for securing the cities were all well attended, so we had a very busy training level as well as the mass notification seminar happening in the ballroom. And it was just wonderful to see our regional partners in person and be in the same place together. So we look forward to any feedback that you have, any comments, suggestions. We are getting started on planning another summit for November 2022. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Corinne?
Looks like Jessica, maybe.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. just a question. There was fantastic content put out this year, and we really appreciate everything that was done to get this together. But could we consider separating the summit from the Golden Eagle exercise? It's a lot of stress on jurisdictions to be able to support all of that.
Yeah, thank you. I think we'll definitely look at that. We've heard lots of comments, lots of work for us too. So we'll definitely consider that. Next year will be a little different because we have the full scale planned for May, and then fall would be a pandemic tabletop exercise. So I want to look at whether it makes sense to have the tabletop exercise at the conference venue, since we'll need a big space for a regional tabletop. And so in this case, maybe it will work better to put it together, but we'll talk with all the stakeholders as we plan it and see what works best.
I just wanted to thank you and the whole team. I mean, I think it felt really great to go to a conference in person. I know a lot of work went into it, and it was so to go. But thanks to everybody. I think as we start getting back to these normal activities, it sort of lifts up a little bit to get back to normal. And that was a huge lift on all of your part. It feels like that, we get a lot of positive feedback in general for all for these events that you've done. So keep up the good work.
All right.
Any other questions for Corinne? So we're going to go to all of the presentations within the site, and then we'll go to public comments. So next is Dominic.
So I purposely sat in the back so I could take this really long walk up to the podium. First time I appeared in front of you without a uniform, so please forgive me if I get a little nervous here. So, good morning, Chair and various members of the approval authority. What a wonderful segue. I can just give you numbers off the top of my head right now for the STC function at the summit. So we had actually, out of the 2 days, we had 71 participants, which is absolutely amazing. A good way to think about STC right now is we have a very focused and robust mission space, which is very simple in nature. It is to enhance the capability sets of our first responders when it comes to rad nuke detection. And how we're doing so is through equipment purchasing, providing the best training, not just training alone, but really the best training in the country. And in that respect, we are really the tip of the spear. So, as STT of San Francisco, we're in year three already. Let me move this forward. So we're in year three. We've designated our regional partners. We've established and leveraged the operations, equipment, training, exercise, information subcommittees, which means that we're socializing and marketizing. And that translates into us leading, really being the tip of the STC spear when it comes to other cities reaching out for our expertise, which we've only developed in this 1 year. And so we've actually provided a lot of our materials to the new cities such as Miami, New Orleans, other cities such as Denver for some of our help in terms of liaisoning between the various subcommittees. We've identified and validated regional requirements for training and exercise equipment and information exchange and reporting. We're currently developing and validating alarm adjudication protocols, deploying and distributing equipment. I'll get into a little further later about the exact numbers. But what that means, really, this translates into we've met every benchmark. In fact, we've probably exceeded most of the benchmarks. We've met every reporting requirement. We've personally met with the Undersecretary of DHS, who have given us very clear marching orders for this year and next year. We were invited just earlier last month to provide our LA regional partners with our skill sets when it comes to security enhancements for the Super Bowl at SoFi Stadium coming up in February of next year. We are now a voting member of the Maritime Safety Committee. And we continue to expand. I mean, we are the only STC that reaches into two states, so not only California, but also Nevada as well. In terms of our equipment purchasing, we have just purchased 1,117 PRDs. The problem is we are not alone in suffering from some of the backlashes and the supply chain issues. We expect to get most of our PRDs by next year, and of course, then we'll be distributing those. We've already purchased 45 RIDs, and we're in the selection phase of purchasing backpacks. Also, if I could just give a great thanks to, of course, our chair, Mary Ellen, for helping us with the summit, and a super special thanks out to Chief Aristeros for her leadership and commitment to the summit, because without her, people would have had to walk between the hotel and the and Pier 38. So her troopers did a great job, and they were great, actually, in terms of helping us secure some of the the training as well. So with that, a great news is that for our current budget, we've survived all of the budget modifications. Those have been all approved. So we're really just looking at getting the right equipment in, providing additional trainings. We've really established great relationships with CTOS, which is the Counterterrorism Operations Support Center in Nevada. They have provided 14 trainings in the last year. We've trained more than 175 first responders, and we're looking forward to them coming out at least 14 more times next year. But here's a problem with the successful summit. Everybody else got to meet CTOS, so I already know that New Orleans has got them committed to a couple, and Miami's got them committed to one, and you know we're only going to get them for 14. So, and I know the SFO wants them out more because you know we have 300 law enforcement personnel out at the airport for SFPD. So, any questions? I'm happy to entertain those or any comments. I'd love to hear them.
Any questions for our today?
That we appreciate your efforts and it helps us enhance our capabilities in San Francisco. So much appreciation.
Thank you, Chief. And, you know, thank you for stating that fact because what a great way. I mean, cops and fire, we absolutely get along. But to really see it right in action and see our troopers with the firefighters just, you know, sharing vans and the only way to tell the difference between the vans is whether they're marked black and white or white and red. I mean, it was pretty amazing to see that kind of stuff. So we loved it. And again, thank you very much, Chief. So, thanks, everybody.
All right, we'll go on to the starting
Thank you and good morning. Excuse me. I'm Jody Travesero, your Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention Program Manager for the Bay Area UWASI, and I'm pleased to provide you with an update today on our program. General Manager Dezik mentioned that we were awarded the second largest grant in the nation, as well as the only UWASI to receive an award. That's good news, and it's really an indicator of the success of this body and their performance over time. We were awarded for four new projects, and there's a theme across the Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention Program projects. They're locally driven, regionally deployed, sustainable, evidence-based, and innovative. So you'll see here a multidisciplinary rollout of these four different projects. The Mental Health Student Film Contest will provide services to 12 different schools across the region. Media literacy and critical thinking training is specific for schools and students. The Combating Online Radicalization training is the multidisciplinary team law enforcement and others on recognizing bad actors online and reporting them. And finally, we have our cross-sector threat assessment training and toolkit, which will take our threat assessment process and specialize it for unique sectors. As you all know, we are also continuing to implement the four projects we were initially funded for across the region, and I'll give you an update on each of those. Projects 1 and 4 continue with very positive feedback. We've met all of our benchmarks. As I mentioned earlier, it's regionally deployed, locally driven. I put a few of the logos of some of our attendees. We've trained a total of about over 500 stakeholders, and December 15th is our final course, and we are now beginning to schedule some train-the-trainer courses. The train-the-trainer courses are being scheduled now in Santa Clara County at the County Office of Education in Contra Costa County, Fire, and also at UCSF. If any of your stakeholders are interested in hosting, please let us know. The training is always posted on the Bay Area UWASI website, and we do push it out to our stakeholder groups. for the Safe School Ambassadors Program, which is led by Community Matters from Sonoma County, we conducted some outreach seminars to find out which schools would be interested and which five schools in particular would be interested. And the five schools right now that have indicated an interest in implementing this anti-bullying program include the Bancroft Middle School in Alameda County, Cesar Chavez School in Sonoma County, Morgan Hill Charter School, Santa Clara County, Lincoln High School, San Francisco, and the International School in Monterey. Once again, we work very hard to make sure it's regional. The third project we continue to work on is the threat assessment protocols and portal for schools. And just like emergency management, you want to look at your current infrastructure to see what you can strengthen or diversify. And I'm very pleased to report that the Data Zone, which is a platform owned and run by Santa Clara County Office of Education that focuses on student success, we will be working on expanding this tool to allow for the multidisciplinary threat assessment and management teams to assess threats and risks. Right now, this platform serves San Mateo County, Napa Valley Unified, and of course all the school districts within Santa Clara County. So that's over 200,000 students. And once again, it's got the data protection elements in it. It focuses on student success. It's integrated foster care. It's a fabulous solution for what we need to do to prevent school violence. Finally, I'm now the chair of a statewide work group called the California Targeted Violence and Prevention Practitioners Work Group. What I'm excited about is this opportunity really to leverage the strength and capability of the UWASI work group model to increase information sharing and get those multidisciplinary teams and relationships moving. We feature best practices across our region, across the state, and the feedback has been very good. Our next meeting for the California Prevention Practitioners Network is in February, and I want to thank all of you for your work and support.
Thank you, Joey.
Thank you.
I heard a lot of things that I didn't know about the program, so thank you. Any other comments or questions from the
guys? I just want to thank Jody for all of her hard work in the TVG. It's really a huge lift to try to coordinate with multiple schools, districts, and you know, jurisdictions. And, you know, she has not given up on that project at all. This is a very important element to all the communities, all the schools, and I think we'll make a big difference as we continue through the process. But hats off to you for your continued hard work on this project.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
Please,
go ahead. Yeah, hi, Jody. Thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, are you still accepting additional schools and stuff? I was disappointed that there wasn't anything in the Tri-Counties areas of Monterey on your list. And I know you were down there, so they obviously didn't want to participate for some reason. And is there any way we can assist with that at the emergency management level? It would be nice to have participation from that part of the county also.
Thank you very much, Gary. And your team has been fabulous in embedding us into your school workforce, preparedness workforce. We did a little bit of dog with the bone. You know, I'm not going to give up. We have identified the Monterey County International School to be part of our anti-bullying program, but we are always open to more schools, and I will do everything I can, right, to engage schools that are interested.
In this process, I'm not totally familiar with it. Do you try to engage the Board of Education or the school district's president, or how broad do you try to do that or target it?
That is a great question, because I initially came into this program thinking it was hierarchical with the County Office of Education elected superintendent. What I've learned is really it's at the district level. The authority's at the district level. And so we reached out to the Department of Education, the California Department of Education, to ask them, how do we reach all the districts? They gave us a distribution list for the Bay Area. So now I have a contact list that touches every school district, and I push it out to all of them. In addition, we've also touched and built a partnership with the California State Association of School Counselors because they are on the front line helping students with this return to school issue, and it's been a difficult time, as you know, for students coming back. And we're also in touch with the Mental Health Authority for the state, as well as the California Behavioral Health Officers. So with that, those are the different stakeholder groups. Of course, we always work with your team. And we've had interesting and new engagements, I would say, with the schools and the school districts. But that's how we do the outreach and try and recruit schools.
Okay, thank you. Just please let me know if there's any way we can assist in facilitating any of those face-to-face meetings.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hello, just a quick update from where we were since I last presented. So this is the Regional Catastrophic Program Grant Program. Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Grant Program. So these grants are very tied to the gaps in the thyroid and SPR, which you recently heard about. We have three RCPGP grants right now, FY19, FY20, and FY21. We're actually the only organization in the country that has three simultaneous awards for the RCPGP grant. So we must be doing something right. So FY19, that is the CPOD planning, commodity points of distribution planning project. And a big deliverable for this one is 70 CPOD site plans around the region, which breaks out to about 5 per jurisdiction. We're doing great on those. San Benito and Solano County get the gold stars for completing all of their site plans, but we're well underway with every other jurisdiction. Well, there's 4 actually jurisdictions that we still have not had a lot of success working with, and they'll be receiving an email soon to confirm whether or not they want to get on board with this or want to give up their 5 sites so that we can redistribute them somewhere else in the region. So you'll be hearing from us about that. We completed a CPOD manager and operations training. We held that virtually. We had 30 participants, I think, and the entire region was represented at that training. And at the end of this month, we'll be piloting another new training, which is a disaster logistics for practitioners training, which is a little bit different than the disaster logistics section chiefs training you might have seen in the past. This one is much more focused on coordination, really, between the EOC and the field and, you know, the actual CPODs and other logistics operations. So I'm really excited about that one. And that'll be coming up very soon. If you want to participate in that or send people to that and you don't know about it already, please let me know right away. FY20 is the pandemic planning project. So this one, we've begun outreach to the jurisdictions around the first 3 key tasks. One of those tasks is the public information toolkit. And the idea behind that is really to try to pull together all of the amazing messaging and public information that was developed during COVID-19, translated into all these languages, pull that all into a centralized searchable database so that it can be available for future needs, as well as to sort of hopefully that'll become a model for a repository for better sharing of these types of messaging across all of our PIOs in the region. The other thing we're working on is starting to outreach for the region-wide COVID-19 after-action report. And the idea behind that is to try to pull together the common themes, common challenges that everybody faced at the jurisdictional level, identify best practices, and put that all together. So it won't be any one jurisdiction's after-action report. It's really going to pull out the things that we all experienced, the challenges and successes that we can highlight. And we'll be doing that through collecting AARs. So if you've already done an AAR for COVID or an interim AAR, I know some of us did them that we submitted to Cal OES. We'll be reaching out to see if we can get those as a starting place, as well as interviews and workshops, and so you'll be hearing more about that.
And then the third big piece of this task is the technical assistance hours for pandemic planning. So updating plans related to pandemic response. So that could be everything from, you know, a surge plan to continuity plan to continuity of government plan, things like that. Recovery plans, and you'll be seeing a survey, if we haven't sent that already, to just get a sense of what kind of plans you might be interested in working on with the contractors. We're not going to start any of that actual work until 2022, but we wanted to sort of get a better sense of what kind of help we need in the region. And then the supply chain project, that's the FY21 grant. This one, we're in the process of doing the procurement. We hope to have a vendor on board by April 2022, so we can get started on that project. I won't go into too much detail on this one, but the core of this one is developing better public-private partnerships, specifically around community lifelines. And a really important piece of this is trying to understand how decisions that are made at the local government level, like closing schools or curfews, how those impact the supply chain, and then what are the implications then, especially for vulnerable populations who are the end users of those supply chains. So this is a very exciting project, and you'll be hearing more about that very soon. Questions?
Hi, thanks for this item. A few thoughts on public safety preparedness summit. Even in this agenda today on the general manager's report, ideas of how Colorado is using their budget ideas at this time. It was mentioned at the preparedness summit, the ideas of trying to learn to speak to how other Bay Uwassis or other Uwassis are working. And to bring that here to the public meeting process, I think would be interesting to see the comparisons. The FIRA ideas in trying to coordinate different agencies, this may be an interesting idea and needed if used responsibly. To also add, I'm not sure we have to have law enforcement defense skills in FIRA, as in FIRA, because they can do this job themselves and simply be guarded in their way, in their work, by law enforcement with weapon training skills, is my feeling. That's my total beginner feeling about how to address that sort of issue. About targeting violence and extremism issues, thank you for this work on this item. I have already offered how surveillance and tech open public policies, accountability, and public oversight from the ACLU can really be of good help in your local school systems. This is what is really the work that is much more than data collection and law enforcement prep work. That's a really interesting idea that I think is nice to hear you guys working on this in these sort of terms. Thank you. And a final reminder with the disaster preparedness catastrophe issues, a reminder that community energy, it's the new programs that are starting around the Bay Area, can help a lot in help with natural disaster preparedness issues and what to expect in our community future. This sort of preparedness is what Bay Uwassi may have to be concentrating on in 2022, natural disaster preparedness things. Good luck on working on that and if it's needed. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, members of the approval authority. And again, I have a 30-minute presentation to do in 10 minutes.
But it'll all be good. Just a couple of things I wanted to cover, well, more than a couple, but one of the major things that we started doing about a month and a half ago was looking at our regional information sharing system In our area, it's the Western States Information Network that does the deconfliction services for our region. And I did an assessment of looking at all of our agencies and how all of the law enforcement agencies were using the system. And the deconfliction systems are set up in a way that if people are doing a enforcement activity, that they're going to go out and do a search warrant, there'll be an eviction, or whatever it may be, that they post that location, the time and date that they're going to be there, so that way if any other law enforcement agency, and we've got 240 plus in our area, are working in that same area, that they know that that person's there. Or in oftentimes that there's conflicts, that people may be working an investigation in close proximity or at the very same location. So our assessment looking at the agencies within our area, we found that 36% of our agencies were not deconflicting their events. And then we looked at the case collaboration investigation, people looking at the same target or vehicle or phone number. We had 33% of our agencies that were not using the system. So I sent out a notification to every one of those agencies and kind of outlined, this is where your agency stands on your use of the deconfliction systems. Many of them didn't realize that they were not using it from the chief executive's level. And this has given us the ability to educate people, make sure that they're using the system appropriately, and more importantly, making sure that they're keeping everyone safe. Because we don't want law enforcement agencies from different agencies showing up at the same locations with guns drawn, not knowing who the others are. It's not safe for them. It's not safe for the community. And also, the goal is to reduce duplication of effort. So that's going to be an ongoing effort that we're going to do every year now to try to let agencies know where they stand and make sure that their people are using it. And this includes for terrorism investigations. And it's both federal, state, local, tribal agencies across our region. We want to make sure that people are being safe out there. The other thing that in our partners at RIS and WISN, they're working with us every day. One of the things that they recently did was a study and a report looking on the Western states on privately made firearms, which are more commonly known as ghost guns. We've heard a lot of stories about that on the news. What we're looking at in the last, from 2018 to 2020, are over 8,000 of those weapons seized, and a good portion of those are all here in California. Actually, 96% of the weapons seized were seized here in this state. Now, for those that aren't familiar with ghost guns, they are basically taking the building a frame. It can be 3D printed. There are companies that make models. Get that mail ordered, you get the parts, you build the gun, and there's no serial numbers on it. Totally untraceable. So one of the problems that we have is that as we're looking at kind of those guns in California, in 2018 we started collecting the data, at least ATF started collecting it. We were over 1,000 guns in 2018. In 2019, over 2,000 guns. In 2020, almost 5,000 of those weapons were recovered. Now, one of the problems, and this has been recently reported in some of our Bay Area news, both print and television, is that agencies aren't recognizing that these are privately made firearms, and they haven't been categorizing them right. So we've been trying to educate people on what a privately made firearm looks like, how to categorize it, and how to report it. We also recently did a request for suspicious activity reports related to privately made firearms, and we've been getting those in on a regular basis now, every time that somebody has one of these ghost guns. Yesterday I was on a call with one of our HIDTA task force commanders in with the whole group, and one of those commanders reported that they've contacted the same juvenile 3 times, and each time he's had a ghost gun. So if a 13-year-old can get a hold of one of these weapons, every criminal out there or terrorist that wants one of these can get them. The other more, which makes it even worse, is that we also have people that are using 3D printers to create Glock auto switches. All you have to do is take off the back plate of the Glock, insert this device. It takes about 2 minutes, and now you have a fully automatic machine pistol. And that's what we're seeing a lot throughout our region, is people using these machine pistols. And they are not the most accurate things on the planet when you're shooting 30 rounds in a second, and rounds are going everywhere. So not only are there 10 targets in harm's way, or mainly not because they're shooting all around them, everyone that's in the vicinity is at harm's way. So our big concern about this is we're trying to educate people on the threat from these weapons, the threat of them obviously getting in the hands of people with nefarious, purposes. So we're having a monthly call throughout not just our region, but also the entire state of California, Nevada, and Arizona, One call with all the intel investigators and prosecutors, and the call with all the forensics labs. Because we've got to have people that are, you know, getting the guns off the street, getting them to the lab so that they can be traced as far as the rifling, shell casings, and find out where those guns are connected to other issues where people may be training. And when you look at Stephen Carrillo, who, you know, Air Force sergeant that attacked the Oakland Federal Building, gunfight in the Santa Cruz Mountains, killing Sergeant Gutzwiller, you know, that weapon that he had was an AR-9 ghost gun. It was a weapon with no serial numbers on it. Now, he was an Air Force sergeant in security forces with access to weapons, but he knew having an untraceable weapon made it a lot less likely that he would be detected by law enforcement. And that's what we're seeing, and that's what our concern is with these weapons out there. And we've already talked about the heightened on the last call, about the heightened risk that we're seeing from domestic violent extremists or those racially motivated or ethnically motivated violent extremists, that these are the folks and these are the weapons that those folks are trying to get to do their attacks. And as we're having more and more, you know, gathering of people, people are actually getting together. We're out there across, across the country, and mass gatherings are starting to build up. We are now having an environment where we have people with a large number of weapons and potential targets. So our goal is trying to collect the information on those threats. At the same time, when we look at things that are happening overseas and things that are happening in Afghanistan with the Taliban taking control of the country, we are seeing a rise in threats directly to our state and our region from foreign terrorist groups that we haven't seen in a number of years. So those threats are starting to come in on a regular basis, which is really disturbing, because the other component of this is not only are they, you know, talking about, you know, deployment of resources here in the country, they're also, again, talking about if you, you know, can't come to our place and join us here, you can, you know, take care of our cause and be an advocate for us by doing an attack wherever you are. And the problem is, when we talk about lone individuals who have been spending the last 2 years, you know, basically cooped up, they have been planning and plotting what they want to do. They have easy access to weapons. Just a bad combination of things. On the school threat front, recently the Attorney General made a request regarding threats to schools, and mainly to school boards, to teachers, to people in the administration. I did a data call across the country on that, and we did not see school threats, actual threats to school boards. We saw a lot of things that may have been First Amendment protected activities. A lot of parents may have been kicked out of sessions with the school board, but nothing that rose to the level of a threat. Now, what we did see are a number of school threats where people are threatening bombings, people are threatening mass casualty shootings. We're seeing more and more of that. So one of the things that we are going to build out, we're actually in the process right now, is a nationwide dashboard on school threats, so we can see these in real time. Because what we have been seeing is a lot of schools closed down because of threats that have been mitigated or found unfounded, and that information has not been moving as fast as the threat has. So we see schools shutting down when the threat's been mitigated just because they haven't got the word. So our goal is to get that dashboard up so people can see when the threat's mitigated, when we have hoax threats that are spreading like wildfire, so that people know that these are hoax threats and can make decisions appropriately. The other component that we've done is we recently had a data call, but on the data call, we also had a call with law enforcement, public safety, school districts, and those that have threat assessment teams to talk about the threats, the threat process, and how SARs and suspicious activity reports for those threats should come to us. And even on the call, we had a number of people that were texting me going, we need to get this threat to you right away. So we're working, making sure people understand the process, how the SARs should come in, how we work closely with our partners around the country to mitigate those threats, and also our work with the social media companies that are seeing these threats in real time and from their perspective. So that way we can make sure that wherever that threat originates within the U.S. or even overseas, that we can get law enforcement on site to at least do a threat evaluation and interview with people to make sure that we're able to mitigate the threats wherever they may be. The other component that we're working on is, you know, the issue that we've had with, you know, gaps in information sharing, intelligence production around the country. A lot of folks, pivot back to January 6th and some of the events that happened there. And the Washington Post came out with an article on October 31 that kind of outlined the red flags of that day, or prior to that day, also what happened that day and what's happened after. And the gaps were pretty deep in there. And the story, if you have a chance to read it, the red flags part, starts out with a conversation that I had on Saturday, January 2nd, with the folks in Washington, D.C., on everything they were seeing and what we need to do to prevent it, and the call that they organized on January 4th that really set the tone for it. This is going to be an ugly event. This is potentially going to be a mass casualty event, along with the outline of the memo I sent out saying this is what we believe is going to happen. And obviously, it wasn't read by the right people, and the events happened that day. But in the post-event era of that, our goal is to improve the communication, especially with our partners in the U.S. Capitol Police. So 2 weeks ago, our first U.S. Capitol Police personnel showed up here in San Francisco, and they are in our office now. And they are strictly a threat assessment team. They're going to help support these threats as we're seeing escalating threats towards member of Congresses, escalated threats related to, you know, for political reasons. And that goes back to earlier this year. We currently have an individual under indictment, Ian Rogers, who's been federally indicted for possession of pipe bombs, five pipe bombs, hundreds of, thousands of rounds, about 15,000 rounds of ammunition, 60-plus weapons. And his plan was to do an attack against what he was framing as Democrats. So these politically kind of motivated threats are rising and escalating. So this team will help support us. And we have a series of folks that are going to be coming in to help us out. Recently, we also did an assessment of the Fusion Center network and the relationship with the FBI across the country. The good news story is that our center came in number 4 of the top rankings in the countries with our coordination with the FBI. The bad news of that story is the majority of the country is not in the same place. And to that end, we're going to be having a national summit to try to figure out how do we improve all these major gaps that we're seeing, which oftentimes are, and I have to tell you, it's because people do not have policies in place. The reason that deconfliction isn't happening in some agencies, there aren't policies in place. There aren't policies on suspicious activity reporting. Our most recent assessment over the last 2 months of suspicious activity reporting, the majority, almost 99% of our reports come from state and locals. We only had a handful of reports that came from federal agencies. They don't have policies. So our goal is, in the summit, is to talk about how do we hold people accountable. How do we make sure that the right people are getting the information and the way that they can consume it? And we will be working on that probably over the next 3 months to build up how do we improve the information sharing. And then the other component of this is how do we make sure that everyone that is in this room that has a need and right to know has the access to the data that they need regarding threats. And we are trying hard to make sure that if a threat comes up, we're getting people on the phone, but I know we're not getting everybody. And I need to figure out how do we do that best? How is the best way to communicate? And we've done a lot of assessments and coordination on this effort, but we need to get to the point of better execution. So that way you get what you need to do because you need to make decisions along with the other folks in this room. And we also need to make sure that everything that we do on the intelligence information sharing side is balanced by privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. So that's going to be my goal and the thing I'm going to be working on. But I will update everybody at the next opportunity that we have. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mike?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Can I open public comment?
Hi, Larry Beekman here. Thanks a lot for that report. That was really, that was nice. I very much liked your last words about doing all this work and how we're considering, the civil rights and civil protection ideas that could be a part of this process. Thank you. My words were going to be about the idea of that in, you know, our local communities at this time, we're dealing with new AI statistics that are needed and data collection. And, you know, for all this good work we're doing, you know, it's the concepts of heart-to-heart dialogue and good communication with each other that can actually work much better than all the technology and data we'll be trying to better practice at this time.
to practice, you know, these heart-to-heart skills, it takes a lot of work and effort, and it's really important part of this process as well, as we've been dealing with the mass shooting incidents in with the VTA in May and the incidents in Gilroy the year previous. So, boy, good luck in these efforts. I wanted to try to quickly offer, it's nice to learn information about the ghost gun issue. The private use and manufacturing of the future of ghost guns, that's a real issue for me, for myself, I worry about. The, you know, it's been nice to hear that we're able to address these large corporate entities that are kind of war profiteers that are been selling these ghost guns in California and throughout the country. To just note that, and it just makes it easy to understand that they can be asked to stop what they're doing, and that you're doing that, and thank you for that. And I wanted to quickly offer from the summit meeting of public safety preparedness last week to quickly conclude. Mike Senna was asked a question from someone from Bayuasi, from one of the attendees. What is the situation? How do we deal with our own sense of state violence and extremism? What do we do with ourselves internally? How do we address that? You know, I've tried to offer here the ideas of heart-to-heart good communication with each other. And, you know, just it was difficult for him to answer. And I hope that it can be easier, that we can address our problems within our own system, and that it can be okay to talk about that openly and to get out. We have these really strong feelings, and how do we learn to better navigate and work together on those things. And Alexander Ocasio, I can't even think of her name right now, Ocasio, I'm really sorry. She's having the issue with a certain congressperson at this time. There really should be a meeting of, we can't allow that in our future. And thank you. Been here. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Sorry, I had trouble saying her name before. For this item, I just wanted to follow up on it seems like we have interesting new budget plans that I think really can be considered as ideas of trying to leave the previous budget systems basically worked something of a wartime pattern and an economy that's used in the time of war. And I think you're finding different ways to try to address that. The 10% padding that you'll be able to have in the future of this budgeting that we can use and rely on can save a lot of hassle for local communities, I feel. And it's a really interesting concept. But I'm a bit uncomfortable where that funding is going to be sitting in wait. And I'm hoping those kind of things can be explained in the future and in future agenda items. And, you guys always do a really good job when you come through with your accounting plans and you actually present final accounting plans. I don't think I've ever seen the better work. And I just hope that within the next year, it may be smart to work to tidy up these sort of issues. 2023 may be a difficult year, I'm not fully sure, to get our house in order by the end of 2022. With these sort of budget issues, it can be real helpful, and always helpful to be prepared. It can help us lead us out of difficult situations easier if we're prepared sooner. Thank you.
The next item is just announcements. Go to the order. Do we have any approval authority members or anything else that have been announced? Okay. And then our final item is general public comments. Is there any general public comments? Okay.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for letting me speak today, and your patience in letting me speak today. It's just my personal feeling about the AOC issue that, we've gone through an incredibly severe trauma situation, and it just seems appropriate to use our better persons and judgment at this time, and for people who think this what they were doing was funny and to be a cool cartoon, that they learned to step back a bit. And it's hard to learn how to ask that of people. Good luck how we can do that. For this item, there were three small earthquakes all at about the same time in the San Ramon Valley yesterday with an average of about a 3.0 range. I hope we will want to very much work to mitigate the potential of larger size earthquakes in the Bay Area. I hope we will also want to work to try to mitigate any of its disaster capitalism ideas and practices, and its ideas of political gain that may be in our future with such a situation. And from this, I hope we can work to teach the ideas to other cities and communities around the Pacific Ocean Ring of Fire and around the world. I hope yourselves at Bayuasi can write back with the ideas and feelings on this subject. It can help a process of how to develop a more mature working relationship and public comment time to ask what can be better health, community health and safety practices. Warm care and more open communication and sharing of knowledge can build the better ideas of trust between all parts of a community in the next few years. These are important ideas to the former approval authority chair, Ann Cronenberg, who would often comment on an interesting transition time of Bayuasi between 2012 and 2014 that I still try to work towards. And I feel that, good practices of open democracy are the ideas of peace and long-term sustainability, not war or more harm. As I'm hoping these good emergency prep ideas can help towards the ideas of equity reimagined and health and human services is how we can more holistically better address community public safety at this time. A reminder that, as my understanding, Bay Area cities have already received much infrastructure budget money in the past few years from their police departments. From this, Oakland and San Jose has begun a new standard this past summer that we can begin to better consider ideas of health and human services reimagined in equity as how to begin to better address local community and safety issues in the next few years and in this upcoming decade in the SF Bay Area. Thank you for your time. As a reminder, we can always change the name of UASI. I'm sorry to say it, but, you know, we can work towards a different, more, you know, I don't know, government institutional sounding name. Thanks a lot for the meeting.
Thank you, management team, for putting on the